Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Notable. Welcome to Notable,
the podcast that finds fascinating stories from the world of music. I'm Stuart McConey.
Yeah. I'm Elizabeth Holker. We cover the whole 500 years, roughly.
Roughly. Sorry. Yes. Of music. Hey, thank you for all your
nice
comments.
Yeah, I've been getting in touch, haven't they?
I know. We've been delighted by the take-up and response so far. Don't forget to subscribe to us and like us and all that stuff. I suppose I should say all that stuff. But Shay Morgan, thank you for all your lovely comments. Ian Barton.
Lee McDonald has been in touch on Facebook. He went to Batley Varieties Club, so enjoyed that.
Quite a few people liking the Batley Varieties stuff. Rob G says it needs a film. Shay Meadows should do a film about it. Yeah, the Batley Varieties
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
It's not. Alan Parker liking the jazz stuff about 1959. More jazz, please. Yep, we'll be doing more jazz.
Yeah. Andrew Brownlow, he went to Bickershaw for the first time last Friday, just after he'd heard our episode on Bickershaw. What a coincidence.
Excellent. Ian Purser, thank you very much. Waka Jawaka. Is the Corrigan of Batley Varieties the same Corrigans who own the amusement arcades in Scarborough? I should imagine they are. Thank you so much for all of your responses.
Keep getting in touch.
Please do. You can follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to us at all the podcast platforms. What are we going to talk about today? Or actually, tonight. This is our first nighttime record.
It is.
I'm going to be controversial and say I have a glass of wine.
I broke all my wine glasses over Christmas, so I've got a tumbler. That's my excuse. It's Terry's birthday today as well. He's 1 year old.
That's Elizabeth's dog. Mm. Happy birthday, Terry. So we're going to talk about, in a moment, I'm going to lead us through a discussion, a little chat, about one of the most extraordinary pieces of music of the 20th century and certainly the most extraordinary premier, Olivier Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time.
Absolutely. And I am keeping it Lancashire.
Yeah.
And we're going to Rochdale, my hometown. Rochdale, Rock City. Just a kind of curious tale about Rochdale and how it influenced the musical landscape, especially in the 70s.
Okay, well, let's start there. You are, as you said, from Rochdale. What kind of town is Rochdale?
Well, this is the thing about these towns outside of Manchester, as you know, Stuart, being from Wigan.
Yeah.
They're actually really rich. They get a bad name, don't they? But they're actually really rich in terms of history and culture. They were all, you know, a really important part of the Industrial Revolution. In Rochdale, it was the cotton industry, especially. I know Wigan was more kind of mining, wasn't it?
Mining and cotton, yeah.
Cotton, yeah, yeah. So the legacy of that is really, I mean, we have some really impressive buildings in Rochdale, the Town Hall, which I do like to talk about quite a lot, modelled on the Houses of Parliament. But all these sort of really impressive buildings from that era, lots of civic pride around that, and a diverse population as well. You know, there's so many different immigrant communities in Rochdale. Sure. So I always think they're kind of strangely outward looking, but also have this really strong sense of identity and community, and, you know, trade unionism is big there. These big characters, as you often get in small places, that are quite proud to be what they are. Open hearts, and because of all that, I think a creative spirit. So one person who found this when he visited Rochdale was John Peel.
Now, this is a good story.
It is.
Did he work there briefly?
Well, his father was a rich mill owner from Liverpool. And when John was a youth, his father wanted to teach him the trade. So he sent him to Rochdale to work in a cotton mill, Townhead Mill, for people who like to collect those kinds of facts.
1959 this would be, wouldn't it?
Around that time, late 50s, early 60s, before he became a DJ. And he just really liked the place. His wife, Sheila, has spoken quite a lot about how it just kind of triggered this lifelong affection for Rochdale, strangely.
Yeah.
I mean, he's only human.
apparently, later on in life, if he ever got bands, if he ever got demo
well,
tapes...
Well, this is the story.
...with a Rochdale postmark, yes. He paid particular yes. attention to them, didn't
exactly.
he?
Exactly. So, years later, beginning of the 70s, just as another slight aside about kind of small towns and this particular era in time, there was quite a lot of investment at this time in art schools in small places around the UK. They had really active arts colleges. The way that art was taught changed in the 50s, 60s and 70s. So there were these really kind of vibrant art colleges, municipal art colleges. Rochdale had one. We had a sculpture park. I think there's parts of it still there. But it was really well thought of. And so many musicians of that era came through art schools, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, the Rolling Stones and John Lennon and, you know, so all the, so this was kind of going on. And these small towns really were developing in the 60s and 70s, these quite vibrant, not just art scenes, as I said, musicians came through the arts colleges as well. So in Rochdale, this was the case, and there was one band leading the way that I'm sure you know, Tractor. That's Jim Milne and Steve Clayton, who they'd been playing together actually since the mid-60s. They're like kind of a proggy, folky, proto-pub rock punk band, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. They were called The Way We Live, weren't
they?
They
were,
Initially, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they were managed by this guy who was a sound engineer and a guitar technician. He was called John Brierley. Right. John Brierley.
John Brierley, yeah, I think.
They got some sort of decent reviews. And they did, as all bands did in those days, sent their demo to lots of record labels in London just as a tape. They sent it to Elektra Records. And via a guy called Clive Selwood, who was working there at the time, this found its way to John Peel, who, despite obviously at that time receiving kind of thousands and thousands of demos, saw the postmark on this record.
Right.
And it was Rochdale. And he opened it and he signed them to his Dandelion Records label.
Yeah.
Not just that, he then gave them £2,000 to buy tons of recording equipment, everything that they needed, basically. They bought a PA, a stereo PA system, loads of recording gear, and they set up this little studio in a terraced house in Edenfield Road in Rochdale, and John called it Dandelion Studios.
Right.
So they recorded their debut album that got to number 18 in the charts.
Wow.
Yeah. And after the back of this success, they set up this little shop on Kenyon Street in Rochdale, which really oddly is also the birthplace of Gracie Fields. So there must be something kind of in the atmosphere around there, as you'll hear, because so much more was to happen. So John Brierley, who I mentioned, their manager and this guitar tech, he started to work out of Cargo as a kind of studio engineer there. He'd bought an old ambulance, actually, and turned it into a recording studio. And he was also a cameraman for Granada TV. So he got to know Tony Wilson.
So just a second, though. Cargo, then, is the name of the studios that...
Yes. So Cargo was set up on Kenyon Street. So,
right.
So
yes.
Tractor set up this little studio in the attic with the money that John Peel gave them.
Yeah.
They called that Dandelion Studios.
But
and
then Cargo,
after their record did so well in the charts, and they started to make some money, they took over this little, it's an old warehouse actually, it was a record shop when I was a kid. We used to get the bus down Drake Street and go there. They sold CDs and guitars and things, and upstairs was this recording studio, and John Brierley, who'd been managing them and producing them, he became kind of the main sort of studio engineer at Cargo Studios. But he'd previously been kind of doing this with this old ambulance that he'd fitted out with an 8-track recording desk, and he was also a cameraman. So he knew Tony Wilson, and he was able to kind of tell Tony Wilson about this studio and John Peel's kind of connection to it. So Tony was kind of catching on to this. Not only this, but he really was... He was a sound nerd. He really, by all accounts, kind of understood sound.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to capture the particular energy that bands of that era had in the live moment. These gigs were raucous, weren't they? This is kind of punk, post-punk, heavy metal, new wave. So the studio, it had a concrete floor, and he just put kind of a thin layer of carpet over it. And there were brick walls. The soundproofing was kind of bare minimum soundproofing. For the real sound nerd, shall we go into this?
How nerdy is it?
Well, the recorder was, it's a Caddy 16 track with, unusually, valves on the record side, which meant you could hammer the tape without getting distortion.
Right.
So this created this really unique cargo sound, which was clean, but sort of raucous and quite powerful at the same time. So Gang of Four went to Cargo to record. They recorded Damaged Goods there.
Yeah.
And then Tony, being savvy and knowing this John Peel connection and the Tractor connection, started to send all the Factory Records bands down there because he obviously realised that if they had a Rochdale postmark on there, then John Peel was more likely to play them. So he sent Joy Division. Joy Division recorded Digital and Glass there. He asked John Briley, Tony this is, asked John Briley if, because they didn't have any money to pay for the recording, he asked him if he would take a punt and get royalties if the record did well rather than being paid. But John Briley said he wanted a day rate, so he ended up not getting any royalties for the work he did on Joy Division and New Order records.
He got 80 quid flat fee instead of future royalties on Joy Division and New Order, which must make him kick himself from time to time.
Most famously, Atmosphere was recorded there.
Yeah.
The Joy Division song. The Four went there. They recorded several albums and singles at Cargo. John Briley got on really well with Mark E. Smith. There was a lot of mutual respect there. Martin Hannock spent a lot of time there, actually. He recorded OMD. He recorded Joy Division there as well. Jerusi Colin. Nico went there to record. Yeah. Echo and the Bunnymen. And all this was just because, you know, it was this kind of magical John Peel connection.
It's the place, isn't it? I mean, yes, we should say OMD recorded Electricity there, their first single, and Wilson said, "You are changing the future of music in this room." Isn't it at Cargo where famously, and you might have seen this in 24-Hour Party People, it's Cargo where Martin Hannett makes Stephen from record on the roof, isn't it?
On the roof. Yeah.
And it sounded, and as Hookie said, it sounded terrible, so he came back inside.
And then, so Rochdale became this, like, it's just weird to think, isn't it? Not many people actually know this, even though there is a blue plaque there, right opposite the blue plaque that commemorates where Gracie Fields was born. And it is a working studio again now, but I think they just do kind of digital mixing there. But the fact is that all these bands of that era and of that particular sound were going to Rochdale. And out of this, the Deeply Veil Festival, which people do tend to talk about, this started in the hills just outside Rochdale. Chris Hewitt, who we mentioned as being the character, I'm sure he's going to pop up throughout many episodes of Notable. He'd worked with Jeremy Beadle on Bickershaw. And so he had the idea, but he was from Rochdale. And he had the idea to do a similar thing in Rochdale. It was all free, Deeply Veil. Yeah. But it's credited as being one of the first festivals to kind of really integrate those punk bands and those post-punk bands into the festival scene. So the pictures are quite funny because there really is a mix of people. The Fall headlined one of the most famous Deeply Veil festivals. Steve Hillage played famously. So it was like that mix of styles.
Yeah, they were. It was the beginning of a scene that kind of went on right into the almost like the crusty and new age traveller scene, because it was a mixture of, you would get hippies, you would get punks, you would basically get people who didn't want to, you know, the Deeply Veil festivals were real get togethers for people who were really rejecting kind of normal society, as it were. Yeah.
There's a picture of a car that's fallen into a stream.
Yeah.
Just on the site. And the people who are trying to pull it out, like, some of them are wearing flares, some of them are wearing drain pipes.
Yeah.
So it was quite unusual, I think, at that time for there to be a mix of those, you know, different music fans. So that is the story of Rochdale and the post-punk scene and its impact in the 70s. Shall I tell you another good musical Rochdale fact while we're here?
I can think of another couple, but go on.
Oh, can you? Okay, well, this is a good one. So, for the benefit of Mr. Kite, the Beatles song, it was inspired by a vintage poster about a 19th century showman called Pablo Fanques. And the poster was for a circus show that was happening in Rochdale in 1843.
Right.
Yeah, so John Lennon just saw this vintage poster for the benefit of Mr. Kite, which was this circus show that was happening in Rochdale. It actually says Rochdale on the poster.
Wow.
Mr. Kite was William Kite. He was a trapeze artist, so he's pictured in the poster. He's kind of hanging upside down. And I think this would have been, like, massive in the Victorian era. Pablo Fanques, he was a huge deal for Victorian audiences. he was an orphan and he'd been sent to the workhouse, so he was a bit of a kind of working class hero. So there you go.
And we've not mentioned, we've mentioned Gracie Fields, also Lisa Stansfield from Rochdale.
Of course, yeah.
Bill Oddie, is Bill Oddie from Rochdale?
Is he? What?
We'll check that.
It could be.
Barb Younger is from Rochdale, isn't she? Barb Younger, the famous singer who's very well known for Brecht and Vile recordings.
Right,
I'm
okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, William Walton's from...
Walton's from Oldham.
Oldham, yeah. Just over the hill.
Well, there you go. Rochdale, Rock City.
Rochdale, Rock City. Anna Friel as well, she's from Rochdale.
Right. Probably need to stop listing people from Rochdale now, because it's going through the electoral register. For our notable exception, then, on this podcast, we have a Rochdale flavour, because my hometown of Wigan has appeared several times in the charts. In
eye roll.
Wigan's Ovation, Wigan's Chosen Few, pretty much all to do with the Northern Soul scene, obviously. But Rochdale's name only occurs once in the history of the charts, and that is, of course, Mike Harding's hit, Rochdale Cowboy. Rochdale Cowboy. Is that an accurate representation of life in Rochdale, Elizabeth? Did people ride around on Alsatian dogs dressed as cowboys?
With clogs and spurs. Although the spurs don't fit on the clogs.
The spurs that don't fit reach on the clogs. Is that how people dress?
Mike Harding, there's Hollingworth Lake, where we like to go walking.
That's right.
There was a video there showing for years and years about the history of Hollingworth Lake, because it was like a seaside town.
It's a Victorian,
and people used
to
go and ice skate on the lake when it froze over. So there was like a historical video that Mike Harding was the voiceover for, which we used to go and watch every time we went to Hollingworth Lake, which was once every 2 days. So that's what people do in Rochdale. And so when I first saw Mike Harding for the first time, and even though he was fairly humbly dressed, he was wearing a very multicoloured poncho, I was
Not humbly dressed.
No, it's true, actually. Although it was kind of...
Multicoloured poncho is not humbly dressed in anybody's estimation. I think the word you're looking for is extravagantly dressed.
It was homemade. It was quite crocheted.
I see, yeah.
It was like a cross between a poncho and a tea cosy.
Right.
Did he say
what this old thing when you complimented him on it?
I liked it, and if anyone knows where you can get them, us, because I'd like one. I was very starstruck
because you thought he was the voice of the Hollingworth Lake pleasure steamer.
The Hollingworth Lake, yeah,
incredible.
Exactly. Incredible. Of our big day out.
Well, that was our notable exception, Rochdale's only appearance in the charts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Come with me now, if you will, Elizabeth, to the winter
of 1940. No, thanks, because we're going to... quite a bleak place, aren't we?
Well, yes, we are. We are going to quite a depressing... This is an amazing story, which has a melancholy element to it, but it's absolutely amazing. The story of Quatuor pour la fin du temps, to be accurate, or the Quartet for the End of Time by Olivier Messiaen, who is, as you well know, a giant of 20th century music, a French composer.
Absolutely.
And this is one of his, if not his major work. I mean, it is an astonishing piece of music that introduced lots of daring and adventurous sound, rhythm, coloration into 20th century music. But the story of its genesis is really incredible. Early in the Second World War, obviously, France has fallen. Messiaen, already a brilliant music student, is working as a medical orderly when the German troops overrun the place near Nancy, where he was a medical orderly. They take him prisoner, and they march him for days on end alongside several other prisoners through in the cold with no sleep, no food, little to drink, camping out in open fields. And he falls in with a group of, incredibly, other musicians.
Musicians, yeah.
Which is really extraordinary.
It's a beautiful story, part of it, isn't it?
Etienne Pasquier, a cellist, Henri Acocca, and a clarinetist, then later Jean Le Boulet, a violinist. But it's essentially, he strikes up a relationship with Acocca, who's a clarinetist. They camp at night in open fields while they're being taken to the prisoner of war camp. And at some point, Messiaen sort of offers him a piece that I think he must have already written. A piece at that point called The Abyss of the Birds, yeah.
You're, I was going to say, he'd already started being, because he was really interested in birdsong, wasn't he? And he used to record, transcribe birdsong and use it in his works, and you hear it here, don't you?
You do, and apparently they play for the first time in this field with Pasquier, who's the cellist, acting as the music stand, holding the music up, and it's an incredibly technically difficult piece, I believe. I don't play the clarinet, you do, but eventually they get to this prisoner of war camp in Silesia. We should point out that it is a prisoner of war camp. It's not a concentration camp. I mean, we associate, you know, names, those horrible names that with their horrible residences like Buchenwald and Auschwitz and Treblinka. And there is a terrible, dark story about the music in those camps to be told that you can find out about how music was used, often in appalling ways, in those camps. But this is different. This is in a prisoner of war camp in Silesia where conditions were very different. But it was no, you know, picnic. It was absolutely not. The French people in there, like Messiaen, were apparently treated reasonably well because France, at that point, were now collaborating. Yeah. The Eastern European Jews and the Poles were treated much worse, though. But I think
there was a certain amount of freedom. Because weren't they all able to club together and buy instruments, even if they were quite battered? But they had the freedom to do that, didn't they? And
I know there were, in a camp of 30,000 inmates, there were five or six instruments, apparently, circulating around. And this is the intriguing thing about the quartet for the end of time. Well, one of them. It's scored for quite an unusual four instruments. Piano, clarinet, violin and cello, which is unusual. The reason for that is it's four of the only instruments that Messiaen had to hand in the camp.
Yeah. Hindemith, weirdly, did write for that combination.
That's right. Of instruments. That is right. But it's not a convention.
It's rare. It's very rare.
So he composes this piece over his stay over the winter of 1940. He composes this piece with these performers. His room was a latrine, an ex-latrine was a toilet, but they had, they're relatively, I think they had a fairly, shall we say, sympathetic camp guard, over lieutenant, because they, I think partly they wanted to show it off to the Red Cross as an example of how enlightened and wonderful they were, the German captors.
Keeping innocent people in prison.
Well, exactly. But they were keen to say, oh, look, these people are giving each other lectures and we're letting them write music and this sort of stuff. He writes this extraordinary 8-movement piece of music over this winter. And we should say a little about the music. The quartet for the end of time, he was devoutly religious, he was devoutly Catholic, and he has this dream, doesn't he, based on the book of Revelations, in which he sees the angel with the rainbow crown.
Yeah, yeah. Who's reaching for heaven.
Yeah. And the end of time.
And saying that this is the end of time. Yeah.
So it's not the end of time as in a depressing or a devastating or desolate idea. It is we will be finally free of the wearisome nature of time. And we'll be...
Because a lot of people associate it, don't they, with his situation. But actually, that's not what he was thinking.
I don't think
so.
I think he was saying that time is actually a kind of wearisome thing that is holding us down. And we are looking towards eternity. Also, we should make the point, the piece is rhythmically extraordinary in that it isn't in conventional time signatures. So it's also, the title is a reference to the fact that Messiaen is escaping from the bounds of normal time signatures as well. Thank you. all kinds of things in there. He studied Greek time signatures from ancient Greek music. He studied tabla rhythms in Indian music. He composes this extraordinary piece. But the premiere in the January of 1940 is this amazing thing. It is held in a halt, a theatre, if you like, but it's a halt. About 350 people are crammed into this place, German soldiers, but the front row is wounded prisoners. Wounded prisoners on stretchers laid out in front of the stage. Oh. It's -4 outside. Snow is blowing in through the cracks in the door. In the room, it's about zero. It's just above freezing because of the heat of the bodies. The performers are wearing these, trying to play in these heavy coats, including Messiaen himself. Oh, I should say that one of the people who often popped in to watch rehearsals, another inmate of the camp, the future French president, François Mitterrand, who was a young soldier there.
Oh.
But the performance,
okay,
later in life, Messiaen, who was something of an overdramatist and a romancer, said the cello only had 3 strings, the piano keys were stuck together. Apparently that's not true. But they did play this piece,
okay,
to people who probably had never heard music like this before. I mean, it is an extraordinary,
yeah,
piece.
It would have been out there,
oh,
like you,
wow,
say. Extraordinary in terms of its rhythms. But and it was all based around prime numbers as well, wasn't it? The patterns.
I think there's all sorts of things going
patterns
on. The 4 instruments themselves very rarely play at the same time. Like there's a piece for solo clarinet in there. There's a piece that's just piano and cello. They very rarely play at the same time. But yes, there are all, yeah, kinds of things informing it. The layers of complexity. But the actual sound, although to us now, I mean, it's still quite daring. I've been listening to it a lot
still
recently.
Pretty out there.
But it must,
yeah,
have,
yeah,
been extraordinary for those people in that camp, these wounded soldiers and these German officers. But they listened, apparently, Messiaen said, with rapt attention. Do you know that great quote? He says, "Never, ever again was my music ever listened to with such rapt attention."
Because they've been so starved of that kind of entertainment.
Exactly. I bet starved of anything like that. But it is an extraordinary thing that I think they thought, yeah, we whether we get it or not, there's something about this music that's compelling. It reminds me a bit, you know, the story that Waiting for Godot's early performances was in a prison, and the prison warders said, "Oh, they're going to go mad. They're going to,
yeah,
this weirdo rubbish. They'll not get this. We'll have a riot on our hands." And apparently, the prisoners in this American prison watched it in rapt attention, and at the end said, "Well, we totally get what that's about. You know, it's about lack of free will and, you know."
Yeah, I mean, it goes to show that if there are no other distractions,
exactly,
that maybe you can, you know, the experience then is different, isn't it? And
exactly,
you can give your full attention to something and perhaps understand it on a whole other level, because,
yeah,
you just, it's impossible to be distracted by anything.
That's
else
right.
in that scenario.
Well, they certainly did on this day in 1940. And it becomes part of the modern repertoire, I guess. It's, yeah, at the time, I mean, it has got its critics. And at the time, people didn't go overboard on it. But as the century develops, I think more and more people see it as a sort of landmark piece. And two of Messiaen's students, who I guess you could say it has an influence on them, Boulez and Stockhausen, later, yeah, go on to revolutionise music. Messiaen lived to a ripe old age. A detail I really love, particularly in this present era, is that they were, Acocca, the clarinetist, and Messiaen were great friends, and they forged this deep bond during the writing and performing of this music. Temperamentally, they were completely different. Messiaen was a devout Catholic. Acocca was an absolutely fundamentalist atheist, a revolutionary, right, and an atheist. And they just put those differences aside. They said, well, we have faith in different things, and they put those things aside. I just think it's really interesting that in this day and age when people just will not listen to anybody of any other opinion than their own.
Yeah,
you wonder,
yeah,
would that happen now? You know, these two guys could say, well, we believe in completely different things, but we respect,
yeah,
each other about this music, you know.
It's, yeah, yeah. And brought together by music as well. That's nice, isn't it? That's lovely.
Brought together by the power of music.
By the power of clarinet.
By the power of the clarinet. Well, there you go. That's the story of the quartet of the end of time.
Wonderful.
The most extraordinary premiere of all time, probably one of the most, if you want to call it a gig, one of the most extraordinary gigs of all time. I don't think in this instance, though, anybody will be getting in touch like the Pistols at the Letter Free,
yeah,
Trade Hall saying, "I was there." I'm pretty sure no one's going to get in touch and say that, but you never know. Right, I'm off to see if I can get a new multicolored poncho.
Yeah. tell me where.
I'm gonna find.
Notable, the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Notable.
Already?
Episode 8? Yes.
No, it's not.
It is, isn't it? Or is it not?
You should put this out, Jeff.
I thought
it's definitely not 8.
It's not far off, you know. Oh, God. What is wrong with me? Why can I not just be a normal person?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.